Moving on with the agenda. Some of y'all haven't met Matt Marshall. Matt is the director of the United Way here in town, United Way of West Tennessee. And he also serves on the COVID task force, regional COVID task force. And I've asked Matthew to give us updates during the Region 6 meetings as COVID, as to how COVID has affected us here in the region and maybe what we can do moving forward. So, Matt, we appreciate you doing that, and I'll turn it over to you.
Sure. Thanks, Richard. I know plenty of people on here. Some of my favorite people on here. Diane, I see you waving at me. One of my favorite people in the world. But there's plenty of others, like Jerry and Dana and plenty of other folks. So, yeah, I won't take a whole lot of time. I'll just provide you guys with the most up-to-date information that I have. Taking into consideration that our COVID task force for Madison County meets every Wednesday. So it's been almost a week since we met last. We'll meet again tomorrow morning, Lord willing. But there have been several things that have taken place over the last week, mostly positive. And so many of you are already aware that, as we entered into the Christmas season, there was a lot of concern going into the holiday break and then now on the other side of it, just because, West Tennessee Healthcare in particular hospital has been just dealing with a whole lot of cases and have really been stretched to their limits. There was a big push as we entered into that holiday season for people to try to continue to social distance during that period. So that we wouldn't see an increase of cases now on the other side of the new year. So far, when we look at the data from the past week or so, the numbers are staying pretty consistent. They generally, like as an example, the last 4 days, today we had 49 positive cases. Yesterday was 68. The day before that, 65. The day before that, 76. Again, this is for Madison County. Those numbers are actually trending down, which is really positive compared to where they were just a couple of weeks ago when they were in the hundreds, the daily count numbers. So that's a positive. We hope that that will continue to be the case, particularly when you consider that we are around January 12th now. So we're about 2 weeks after the new year period. And so hopefully you'll see those numbers continue to kind of go down as we move forward over the next few days. I think that once we get past somewhere the 15th through the 20th, which is that 14-day, past that 14-day window after New Year's Eve and New Year's Day, when there was a chance that there were people gathering together still, that you'll see those numbers hopefully decreasing all the more. Hopefully that'll be the case, but you also have to take into consideration during that holiday break, there is a chance that the numbers are down because less people were working and less people were out and about. So you have to take that into consideration as well. But maybe that's played a part, was a positive thing that was going on to keep these numbers low during this period. So again, we'll keep watching them over the next week or so, but the next 7 days or so will tell us quite a bit. Obviously, the biggest news over the last several weeks has been, we've gotten vaccine beginning to roll out in our community. That's happening all across the state and all across West Tennessee. And so locally here in Madison County, we are in phase 1A1 and 1A2, which primarily looks at individuals who are 75 years or older, our frontline workers like your nurses and doctors, those frontline people, frontline medical workers, I should say, or individuals who have pre-existing conditions that make them particularly vulnerable. And so those are the folks that are eligible to receive the vaccination in this first round. And so as many of you know, last Thursday, there was a rollout at the fairgrounds here in Jackson, which you probably saw the lines as I did on WBBJ. Incredibly, incredibly long line, all the way from the fairgrounds down into Venus. further into business. So they will do that again this Thursday. There's another round of vaccinations that will take place that the health department will be distributing this Thursday. It'll begin at 9 a.m. on Thursday morning and go till 6 p.m. on Thursday. And so they were able to vaccinate a little over 1,500 people last week. And I believe that that's around, I'll find out for sure tomorrow, but I believe that's around the same number of vaccinations that they'll have available because they're normally distributed in 1,500 to 2,000 level of doses. That's how many they get at any given shipment. So probably somewhere around 1,500 to 2,000 people will be potentially able to get vaccinated. Many of you also, one other thing to talk about in the vaccinations is that the vaccinations can only be thawed and used during a certain time period. So many of you have heard this already, that if they take those vaccinations out of the cooler system that they use, they either have to use them within a certain period or they have to discard them. They can go back in the cooler within a certain period if they're not been open or anything like that, but it's a very short window. The hospital and health department and others have done is they have a very strict system on when those vaccines, when the doses can be removed, and they have a plan on how they get through those within a certain time period. There's a scenario in which they don't use up enough of them and they know they're not going to be able to use up enough of them within that window and that they might have to discard them, that's when they go to that list, that backup list that anyone in the public can get on. So anyone in the public can sign up to be on that list. As of last Wednesday, there were already 4,000 people who had signed up as backups. I imagine that has grown since that time. The challenge is, just to be very honest, the challenge is for that list is that there are so many people that fit within that phase 1A1 and 1A2 that are first priority that the likelihood of you getting called if you're on that list is very low, particularly if you've gotten signed up in the last week or so. The reality is that you probably, and again, I don't want to discourage anybody from signing up on that list. By all means, do that. But the reality is that you have probably a better likelihood of us getting to the phase that you would normally fit in and getting the vaccine at that time than you would getting a call on that list. And again, that's just because there's limited doses. There's so many people that they have to get through. And they normally have done a really, really good job of planning that out where they know they're not going to have 100 doses left. They know that that's not going to be the case. They might have a dozen. And so, again, the likelihood of you getting called is pretty low. But, again, that's not to discourage you. If you feel so much, so led, by all means, sign up on the list. Only other thing, again, this is stuff you guys I'm sure would know by now, is how the doses work. The hospital is administering primarily the Pfizer vaccine. The health department is administering primarily the Moderna vaccine. And the main reason why that is because what's necessary to keep them cold in their freezers are different. The Pfizer has much higher necessity. It has to be kept at a much colder temperature. And so for that reason, the hospital is more equipped and has the equipment to be able to do that. And so they're administering the Pfizer. Moderna is being administered by the health department. They're very, very similar in how they work. You have to, as you guys have probably heard, you have to have two doses. The first dosage will make you about 50%, will get you to about the 50% threshold of your body being able to have the likelihood of fighting off the virus if you were to get it. After that second dose, that jumps up to about between 95 and 98%. And so that's why they recommend those two doses, because that second dose is kind of your guarantee to a degree. Obviously nothing is 100%, but That first dose you'll get, then with the Moderna vaccine, approximately 21 days later, you are eligible to get the second dose. But the other vaccine is 28 days later. So one is 3 weeks, one is 4 weeks. But other than that, they're very, very similar. And so we have seen a very high rate of our frontline nurses and doctors getting the vaccine, which is a big plus, and again, should reassure a lot of us. As far as I know, we've not run into many hiccups with that process, and it'll continue to be ongoing as we make our way through the general population. No one is required. No one is forced to get it. No one at the hospital, no one at the health department, no one anywhere is forced to get it. No one is forced at all. That's completely, voluntary. But it will take, several months for us to be able to work through the general population. And so I get the question quite often, when is it being suggested that it will be, people like myself who are, younger and generally healthy, when will folks like us be able to receive it? Probably looking somewhere March or April is probably realistic. And so at the earliest, that's at the earliest. So I think that's all I got, Richard, unless there are any questions about any of that.
Any questions for Matt? Matt, thanks so much. I guess age does have its privileges, huh? That's, just on a side note, we were notified by the health department this week that the people working in our residential programs could come in and get their shots. And we left it up to the individual employees whether they wanted to take them. And we could go back on the 25th, but I think probably 90% of the people working in our residential programs went on and got the shot during the first round, and probably the rest of them will get them on the 25th. So,
I didn't mention that one of the populations that is going to be highly focused on, in this first round as well, are all of those. I mentioned 75 plus, but specifically as well, in addition to that group, all those who are living in nursing home facilities, that group as well. And all the people who work in those facilities. And so I'm really, really happy to hear about the folks who are working, in the areas you mentioned, Richard. That's huge. That's a really big deal. We need to make sure that happens.
Matt, I hope there's a time soon we don't have to call on you to give that report. So we are making progress. Thanks so much, Matt. We'll move on now to committee reports and, talk to Megan. Megan, you've got something for us for the Children's Committee.
I am. Gary and I are going to meet and do some pre-planning. So we will have our first Children's Committee meeting of 2021 on Thursday, the 28th at 9:30 a.m. And we will send out a meeting link. That way we can get everyone online. We're going to brainstorm for priorities, but Jerry and I kind of touched base on maybe some priorities for our region. We'd like to return to trying to make a pediatric service guide, resource guide, and be able to get that out. We also talked some about handle with care, and so we might invite someone from Weakley County. Weakley County and Tipton were two of our counties in Region 6 that we're starting to implement that. To maybe talk with us about that process. We also talked about the sharp increase in CPS investigations and removals, and talked about maybe teaming as a children's committee to offer some child abuse identification and reporting training to businesses that might frequent homes in the community during COVID, such as pizza delivery places, Lowe's and Home Depot that might be doing appliance deliveries. Those places that aren't necessarily touched by the Human Services Committee, a community to be able to share that information. We've also, the committee, there are lots of upcoming online summits and conferences it's going to be a busy spring where we might be teaming to do some training there. But one of the things that we're attempting to network on is to see if maybe we could get Dr. Shelley Fiskus from the Department of Health to do a training or an information session on the progress on the pediatric COVID vaccine. We know the adults have gone through the trials, and as Matt was really specific, talked about the rollout, but that is for ages 16 plus. So right now we don't have a vaccination for pediatrics. We also want to go ahead and start putting together summer activity resources to have, we were kind of scrambling last summer with talking with Health Connect and other places to hold mental health summer camps or shifting their IOP to daytime. We don't know if the daycare allowance that allows additional children to go to our YMCs and Boys and Girls Club will still be active come summer. So we as a committee need to really start to pull together people for summer resources. So that's kind of what we're looking at tackling in the spring. And we'll start working on that in our first meeting. So we're excited.
Sounds like you're going to have a busy spring.
Yes.
Thanks a lot, Megan. Jerry, did you have anything you want to add to the children's report?
Some of those activities, I'll just give TCCY a shameless plug. One of the activities we've got at the end of the month, specifically around children in the state of COVID, is going to be our legislative event, January 29th from 9 to 11. It's virtual. Shout out to Matt Marshall for helping me and Dana and Gwen Wright with our Shelby County coordinators. We're all doing it as a group this time around, but it's going to be at the end of this month. We've got several speakers, specifically for our child and well-being domains and wrapped around COVID. So come on and join us. We're about halfway full. We can only have about 500 on the Zoom call. So if you're interested, I can send out the registration. Also, our county profiles came out. So if anybody needs that end of the year data, our county profiles came out as of yesterday, and that's our again our kids count, child well-being data. So if you need specific county data, that came out yesterday.
Just as an update, we are at 382 registrants for the legislative event, so we've only got 118 spots. So if you want to join us, go ahead and register.
Thanks, y'all. Appreciate it. I will, you know, we tried to get an adult committee chair appointed a couple of meetings ago. We weren't able to do it, and I've been trying to fill in. There was an adult committee meeting, statewide meeting, on the, I got some notes here somewhere, on the 14th, the day after our last regional meeting, where they focused on faith-based opportunities in the church. Dr. Monty Burke spoke there to try to come up with some ideas to get the faith-based community more involved in some support services that they could do. There is an adult committee meeting tomorrow. I hope to set in on that. At this time, what I would like to ask is for a volunteer, for somebody that would chair that adult committee. And then maybe we could appoint or get some volunteers to serve the adult committee. Okay, now, I know y'all are overwhelming my computer screen, so hang on a minute. Okay, now, one at a time. Okay, that didn't work, huh? Okay, I will, at least for the time being, try to be involved there where I can. And then maybe we get off this call, I'll do a little something. I don't know. We'll come up with something.
Hey, Richard.
Yes.
Richard, this is Dana.
Hey, dear.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I got you.
Okay. I just want to mention, Jerry and I have been working, and some others have been working on a work group with Amy Bechtel, our faith-based regional coordinator, and she is working on a faith-based ministry conference, a West Tennessee conference. A date hasn't been nailed down for sure, but, you know, I just didn't want this, if you, you know, this adult committee to go off and try to plan something else. I mean, I think it should be a joint effort, you know. I just didn't know if you knew about that or not.
Well, I talked to Amy about it, and I knew a date wasn't set, but this is mostly just as a region, maybe working on things like the needs assessment and participating in the statewide adult committee meetings that they have. Not so much as planning some event.
Well, right, I understood that as well. But I thought, well, y'all might get creative and decide you wanted to do an event. So I didn't know if you knew for sure.
Okay.
So I just wanted to throw that out there.
And thanks for doing that too, Dana. Okay, I think most of you have heard of the Lifeline Peer Project. It's a program the state pursued a couple of years ago and then expanded off of that into things like recovery navigators and regional overdose prevention specialists. And I've asked Diane Sherry. Diane's an old friend that took over those programs a couple of years ago, expanded them, and helps get the department's programs out in the community. And I've asked her to come today, and she is part of the regional council, but I asked her to report today on maybe what's happening around Lifeline Peer Projects and ROPE and Recovery Navigators, things like that. So, Diane, I'll turn it over to you. If you'll catch us up, we appreciate it.
Thanks, Richard. Can everyone hear me? Feels like I have an echo, but... Okay, so yes, I appreciate the opportunity anytime to talk about the exciting things that are going on in our community, particularly related to the state-funded programs that the Region 6 has been blessed with. As Richard was talking about the Lifeline Peer Project, it's been around since 2013, and it was basically set up for two reasons. To break the stigma around substance use disorder, as well as to create meetings and other types of programs and resources to help people find treatment and recovery. I'm a person in long-term recovery myself, as Richard knows, and, you know, when I got sober back in 2003, I didn't have anyone that I could call to say, can you help me get into detox? All I had was a probation officer that was tired of violating me because I couldn't pass a drug test, and Judge Harvey that was he was tired of seeing me in his courtroom. So it was just, you know, honestly, I just had to find my own way through God's grace and mercy and through 12-step programs. But luckily today, we have so many programs in place that can help someone, and particularly my focus is on those people that are falling through the cracks, the people that don't know what to do, the people that might be arrested, and they're recognizing that they might have a problem and not sure what to do. And I'm able to work with them, work with their probation officer, work with their public defender and the judge. And one of the things I want to say, if I can just take a minute to say, in terms of Ellen Abbott and what an honor it has been to work with her on these criminal liaison programs and on the recovery courts. The recovery courts have had huge success, and I think in part by Ellen's commitment to those programs. And I've served on, you know, treatment teams over three different counties here in Region 6, and the success rate is quite remarkable when you think about how a 28-day inpatient program, you know, while that does provide, a stabilizing period for someone who might be struggling with a substance use disorder, it doesn't always give you what you need in the long-term picture. And the recovery court programs allows that monitoring and that day-to-day discussion, and people who are working toward the same goals to work with the recovery court administrators, and they literally walk alongside them and help them through the process with classes and workshops and MAT MRT programs and relapse prevention and all the things that just raises awareness and educates people on what this thing is, what that this is a disease, that the science behind the brain tells us that this is a disease, and it's not some moral failing that they have done something wrong or they've forsaken their family or their children. They actually have a disease that does not allow them to make the right choice when it comes to substance use disorder. And what I want to say about that here recently, we have had, you know, what I would call the perfect storm of problems in our community where substance use is prevalent, and Richard can certainly attest to this. You know, last year when COVID started and we started the process of trying to understand what was happening and the borders, and the president, one of the first thing he did was close the borders, and then he turned around and they did the stimulus package where they dropped thousands of dollars in the pockets of every American. And what that happened in our communities was the closed borders did not provide drug dealers with the supply to meet the demand that was going to be coming when people who normally spend $20, $30, $40 a day on their drug of choice are now coming to their drug dealers wanting to spend $100, $200, $500, $600 to get high. And it just, it caused the drug dealers to scramble, because they are going to get your money no matter what, to scramble to try and get the product to serve these drug addicts. And they, that's when we saw the increased rise in overdose deaths. Just to give you a comparison, I took this job in 2017, late 2017, and in 2018, I lost 3 people to death by overdose. In 2019, I lost 4. And in 2020, I've lost 71 since March 13th. So this has been, when I think about the relationships that just someone in long-term recovery through the Lifeline Peer Project, through the Recovery Navigator Program, and also the Regional Overdose Prevention Specialist, the very basis of the work we're doing is establishing relationships with these people. It's not like we're handing them a brochure when they first meet us and say, good luck with that. We're actually walking with them. We're helping them to decide detox programs that might work for them, 28-day residential, sober living, whatever they're needing, IOP, medication management, counseling, whatever they need, we're walking with them, something I did not have when I got sober. And we're able to, what I consider, capture these people that are falling through the cracks. The Lifeline Peer Project started out with 10 of us across the state working by regions, and we've expanded that program, thankfully, to where there's, I think, close to 18 now, 16, 18 across the state, and we targeted the rural disparaged counties. And I'm happy, so proud to say that Sarah Mays, who is on this call, is a hybrid lifeliner who has come aboard this past year and assisted me and all of our team across the state with identifying these people, getting them into treatment, getting their pre-screens done, and walking with them to provide them services. And I can't say enough about Sarah. She's like my work wife. You know, if I've got something I can't get done, I'm able to pass that to her. And I don't even go check back to see if it got done or didn't get done, because I see the fruits of her labor. She has a heart like ours, and she is there to help and assist and provide these people with the necessary programs and resources that they need, particularly in the rural areas. I can't tell you how difficult it is when COVID has crippled the 12-step fellowships in terms of where they meet or having meetings, you know. So it's very hard to provide these resources for people who have to look to a way of replacing what their old life with something that their new life can look like, which is without drugs. So if they don't have the support of a 12-step fellowship or sponsorship or, you know, some type of program that they can attach themselves to, it's crippling for someone who's an addict who needs to develop a way of living that doesn't include drugs. The Regional Overdose Prevention Specialist, I really believe, I mean, I can't say enough, I think I was just standing in the right place at the right time, and the moon and the sun was aligned where I hit the trifecta in my jobs, where I'm able to act as a Lifeline Peer Project Coordinator along with a Regional Overdose Prevention Specialist and also a Recovery Navigator. The ROPES program is a wonderful program that puts Narcan in the hands of the people who need it. The first couple of years that we had this program in place, we armed every law enforcement officer, every fireman, every agency with Narcan. But then this past year with COVID and everything that it has going on, we said we need to get this in the hands of the people who need it, the what we call the street outreach, what we call the high-risk individuals. So I spend just about every weekend, and particularly here since the second stimulus has rolled out, I have spent every weekend in the high-risk motels within a half mile of the interstate. You know the ones I'm talking about, Scottish Inn, Executive Inn, Travelers Inn, Roadway Inn. All of these places we're dealing with high-risk individuals that are opiate users. Their drug dealers are living in the same hotel. They don't even have to leave. It's one-stop shopping. And thanks to Sarah, she and I have developed relationships. We went to JPD, and we sat through, and we took donuts and snacks and stuff to every roll call, and we met every police officer, and we handed them our resource cards, and we told them, if you have someone who has overdosed and you've been called, and so many of those do not want medical treatment, they don't want to be seen, they don't want the police there, they want to just get out, I said, please drop these resource cards just on the coffee table or the TV or somewhere where they're going to be able to see those a week or two or a month later down the road, where they can call Sarah or they can call me and they can finally get the help they need. We've got to get our names and phone numbers out there because, you know, the window of opportunity to help someone who has decided that they do have this thing and their life is on the line and they're going to die if they don't do something different. Those are the ones that we're after. So, again, my girl Sarah, we're like little Twinkie sisters. We work side by side. We're actually going tomorrow to tour Mirror Lake Recovery Center and Freeman Ministries in Burns, Tennessee. We're getting our resource list. We're building on it, and we're able to provide these resources to people who are in need, and I can't say enough about it. Richard knows how much I love to talk about what I do, and I appreciate every opportunity that you give me, Richard. Thank you.
I'm having trouble getting my little thing down there to work right. And I can what she says about walking people hand in hand to treatment. I don't know how many times I've seen her little escape or escalate or whatever that pull up out here in our parking lot, and here's she bringing somebody in. And it's really helped to get people in quicker. And Diane, we appreciate road programs, Lifeline Peer Project, and Navigator Program. A huge addition to addressing what I believe is right now our second largest public health problem behind COVID. So thanks for sharing with us today. That's really all we have on the agenda other than agency reports. Like to give everybody this opportunity to report on their agency, anything going on, new programs, just announcements. So I'll open the floor to any announcements from agencies. Well, I guess I'll, you know, we're building a new building. We're building a 12-bed housing for women. We thank Dina from Cary, and of course Jason that works with us now, the regional housing coordinators that helped us get that up. We thank the department for the grant, and then we thank the Kirkland family for some private money they put towards construction of the building, and it'll be part of our continuum where for permanent housing, a 12-bed dorm where women can move in and stay as long as they need to stay. We're grateful to everybody that helped make that happen. Any other agency reports?
Hey, Richard.
Okay, just in closing, yes.
I was just going to say this is Lori Hinden with Cary Counseling Center, and I can't remember whenever the rollout for the school-based behavioral health liaisons, if I had made that announcement or not, but I've had to get off and go and accept a couple of calls because it is absolutely phenomenal. We had four new grants that we were awarded to put therapists in the schools. And working in the school systems is where parents that don't have the ability or grandparents that are raising kids don't have the ability to take off work or to maybe don't even have the gas money to get their kids, to a therapist to be able to see them. And our therapists are there in the school every day with the teachers side by side, working with the teachers, the cafeteria workers, anybody in the school to make sure our kids are taken care of in that environment while they have them captive. And so I just wanted to, if you know it, I've only got actually five of them all together, but there are at least one school in every county that has a behavioral health liaison now. I know Pathways has several counties where they have them. They're the only ones probably that I know just because they're here in our area. But it is wonderful, and I just wanted to brag on the schools and the Department of Education for letting us, I'll say, bust up in their territory, because I know sometimes they, those barriers are hard to break down, but all the schools that we're working with are phenomenal. We have one in Lake County, which is at Lara Kendall. We have one that is in Huntington at Huntington Middle School. We have one that is here in Obion County at Obion County Central. We have one in Weakley County that is at Greenfield School. And then we have one in Henry County that is at Inman Middle School. And this is just an exciting time because this is their first real week to be in the schools working hand in hand. And, they were calling me about, I just got through doing this intake. What do I do next? Making sure that even though they know, they just want to be reassured they're doing the right thing. So I just wanted to give that shout out to the state, to the department, and then in addition to the Department of Education for letting us be able to do these endeavors.
Lori, that's great news. It really is. It's a program that kids can't advocate for themselves, and it's real important that people like you and the department and that are willing to tackle that and get services to kids that so many times don't have a voice. So we appreciate you.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.
Anything else? Before we close, I just feel a need to say thank you to y'all. This, the last year has been tough on everybody. And I know everybody on this call. And to work with people like you all to make sure the services that we all provide get to the people that need them, I'm just honored to be part of that. And I thank each one of you for, during these times when there's so much at risk. It's not just you at risk. It's your family, the people you love, and, the fact that you take the precautions that you do, but you continue to provide the service we're charged with providing on the behalf of all the people that we serve, that you serve in your agencies. I say thank you. Our next meeting scheduled for April 13th. We'll see what COVID holds for us at that time. Hopefully, someday we can all get back together, because I miss the hugs and the handshakes. I'll close with saying I love you and I appreciate you being here today. Everybody take care.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for being safe.
Thank you.